The point of this episode is we want to make sure that we are discussing technology in the context of their business and what our clients actually relate to, and essentially reminding all of us that's why they're paying us to code. The code is just the
means to get a business goal met.
Exactly. From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, Emily and I are going to talk about demystifying web development for your clients. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Mithra62's Backup Pro, a complete backup solution for WordPress, Expression Engine 2 and 3, Craft, PrestaShop, and Concrete 5. We use this one ourselves for some of our client sites. It's insanely customizable and includes automated backup integrity, 8 built-in storage locations, console routing. Basically, Backup Pro was built to make disaster recovery as painless as possible. Just visit backup-pro.com to get started.
So today we are resuming our demystifying web for clients series. Our first episode, we tried to talk about web design and the terms involved in web design from a non-technical client/human-friendly perspective. And so this episode, we're going to take that same approach to the topic of web development. So before we actually get started, we do recommend that if you haven't listened to the first episode, go do that. There's a lot of context that we provided in there about the reasons and the value for taking this approach that I think is important to listen to before you dive into this episode with us. So we'll include that link in our show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just to reiterate why we're even doing this series, it's really important to take the time to educate our clients. I think one of the most important skills that we have isn't necessarily even our coding skills or our design skills, but how to communicate the value of those particular aspects of our business in terms that the people who's signing the checks can understand. And we want to make sure our clients are comfortable from the very beginning of all of our projects, because that sets the tone for how we communicate throughout the entire thing in the first place, right? I mean, it's about setting expectations.
Exactly. I mean, and this is all learned the hard way of not taking the time to do this and having surprises come up in terms of a client saying, well, I thought I was going to get this.
Right.
Or why didn't this happen? You know, taking the time to make sure they understand what we are saying and we understand what they're saying pretty much eliminates those sorts of surprises. And that, of course, means you don't have disappointed clients.
Right. And I mean, the impetus of all of this, too, beyond the fact that they understand what you're saying and you're understanding what they're saying, is putting it all in context to their business needs, right? Like, the point of this episode is we want to make sure that we are discussing technology in the context of their business and what our clients actually relate to, and essentially reminding all of us that's why they're paying us to code. The code is just the
means to get a business goal met.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so this series and this episode, we're trying to make sure clients understand our value, the work we do, and how we communicate.
Yeah. I kind of think it's like one of the things I find frustrating, even though I've been doing this for 20 some odd years. Most people I meet, you know, I have like an exterminator come to the house or, you know, a landscape contractor. And, you know, eventually they ask what I do. And I say, oh, I make websites. And they're like, huh, I just still don't even get it. But if I were to say, oh, you know, I'm a car mechanic, people know what that is. And they understand it's a craft. It's a specialized skill. And they understand the value of a mechanic and why you get your money's worth when, you know, you do or don't pay for mechanic's expertise.
Right. Because there's all these types of nuances, you know, in regards to that as well. And I feel like using the car mechanic or car analogy even is pretty good because it's actually pretty complicated how a car works.
Yes.
But we all need to have our cars serviced. at some point. And we don't need to necessarily know exactly every single nuance and how that works, but people should still be able to communicate back and forth to understand why something is not working and why you're paying for them to fix it or not. Right?
Yeah. Especially, I love the car analogy for this because I have a car. It's almost 20 years old. But when I first got it, brand new car, it made this noise when I got over a certain speed.
Right.
And I could not communicate with the mechanic for the life of me for like 3 years, different mechanics, different places, trying to get them to hear it and understand it. And, you know, it ultimately never got solved, and I just tolerate this noise. So,
right. And we're trying to avoid that for web design because there are a ton of clients who go to us with a particular issue or problem and something needs to be solved. But because there is a language barrier of understanding, then things don't get resolved, or problems that they weren't actually asking you to solve are solved instead while this niggling issue is still around, right?
Yeah. And also, if we don't take the time to communicate and try and speak in terms that our clients can understand, it contributes to misperceptions about our industry.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
People not understanding what we do or why we do it, or having a perception that web developers are hard to work with, you can't count on them, they do stuff, you know what I mean? So we hear it all the time, clients who are coming to us from a bad experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the issues why that happens is that there's just so many assumptions that people, like, our knowledge is common knowledge, and it really is not. Just to give you a real world example, very, very, very recently, we had a client kickoff. And during that kickoff, we made sure to ask her if there were any terms that we were using that we're unfamiliar with. The thing is, like, even when, for example, Emily and I are very conscious of this issue, hence why we're doing this series in the first place. And yet, we still throw out these terms because it's our language, right? Without even thinking. So it's really important to ask your clients or your prospects if anything that you've said needs clarification. And so with the super recent kickoff, it was just really interesting when we mentioned that she did bring it up. There were terms that didn't make sense to her, and they were actually front-end terms, which is the point of this episode. And I also want to point out that this particular client is super smart, financial litigator, but she didn't understand what HTML and CSS actually meant. And that's the building blocks of the web, right? And we like, we just assume like everybody knows what HTML and CSS is, but that's just really too far into our heads to make that assumption, because not everybody understands what that means. They might generally understand that means, okay, I guess they're talking in the context of a website, so I guess these acronyms mean website related. But she didn't actually quite understand. But because we point blank asked her if there were terms she didn't understand, and perhaps also because of the type of client she was, you know, she's a financial litigator, she was comfortable pointing this out and asking for specifics. But not all clients are like this.
And I think that's important to underscore. Just because your client didn't say that they don't understand does not mean that they understand.
Yeah.
It can be scary or intimidating, or who knows, maybe someone's just not comfortable mentioning that they don't understand something. And so we make a point of asking.
Right. And when you do that, it sets the stage for the rest of the project, you know, when communication is going great, and then you'll have faster calls, and then there'll be less versions and change requests simply because you've already set the tone and already set the language.
Yeah, I've been so pleased with this particular project because we're literally experiencing this. We're more efficiently using our hours because she understands what we're doing. Because we took that time at the beginning to really underscore our process. We're trying to use the same language when we hand over a deliverable, so she has the context of previous conversations. And we literally are not having to do as many versions of deliverables, literally, which is great.
Right. Because we're not having to over explain something because we've already set the tone at the very beginning. Yeah.
She understands the deliverables when she gets them and doesn't ask for things that aren't part of it because she understands that's not part of that particular phase.
Right, right. So I think it's really important, you know, especially in a kickoff or obviously the entire project, to make sure that you have a conversation like this where you actually ask them, do you understand the terms this and this? And then you actually wait for them to explain it to them. Don't talk over them. Wait for them to explain it in their own words and see if they're correct, you know? Because sometimes they might re-explain it to you, because that's sometimes what happens too. Like we've had experience where we explain, so do you know what HTML is, or do you know what this is? And then they're like, oh, I think it's this. Like, I think we'll talk about accessibility later on. But our other client, we realized that she didn't actually understand what accessibility was after the conversation continued, right? And then we had to like break down the actual definition, and then she understood, right? Because it really is so important that, you know, everyone is on the same page.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's also important that when you're discussing language, is that it needs to be an agreed upon term between the parties that are involved. So what I'm saying about that is that the terms that we're going to be using on this episode might have broader meanings, and I don't want to debate specifics, you know, like, because I feel like in a room full of front-end developers, there'll be a ton of definitions of even what front-end development means, right?
Yeah.
So I think the emphasis on we want to talk about front-end in human terms and that anyone can understand should be the focus of this episode and your mindset as you're listening to our discussion.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with just a couple examples of how we as designers and developers, or even project managers,
right,
may get it wrong when talking with clients, where we just get too technical.
Yeah.
And even if you're working with someone who's in IT or even a developer, you can't assume that they know what you're talking about because they have their own set of expertise. You have yours. So take the time to get to know what their context of where they're coming from. Don't make any assumptions.
Exactly.
Like, for example, Angular, React, those are names of JavaScript libraries, frameworks, but not everyone is privy to that. In fact, most of our clients don't, if I said that, wouldn't know what it is. And in fact, I'm not even completely familiar with all the nuances of libraries. And frankly, I don't need to be to do my job.
Right.
I don't rely on frameworks. But our clients don't need to be either to get the project done.
Right.
Frankly, it's not appropriate to throw Angular or React at a client and expect them to have any sense of what that means.
Exactly.
So that's where you can get it wrong, throwing these names out there that maybe they're written about a lot within our industry or talked about, but they don't have context for clients.
Right. And as you mentioned too, even if you're talking to someone within IT, and as I mentioned, even the definition of what a front-end developer means can be a loaded thing. So just always enter a conversation that's with an open mind and in a helpful, generous manner where you are in a teaching mode, right? As opposed to like judgment mode, as in what? You don't know what Angular is? Is that actually appropriate to the business or the project? Let's get to that type of conversation instead. And besides those terms, I think what we really get wrong is the acronym soup that we force clients to eat. So terms like, again, these are acronyms that we in the industry are used to, but no one else is, like HTML, CSS, JS, SEO, RWD, HTTPS. And you might think like, well, I could just break down each acronym, but doing that actually doesn't explain anything. For example, telling your client, well, HTML is hypertext markup language. How does saying hypertext markup language actually explain that it's the code that adds context and meaning to the text and images to your site? At some point, you don't even need to define the acronym or explain it. You should just say it adds context and meaning to the text and images to your site.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't muddle the definition.
Yeah. And don't throw tech sounding terms like semantics or accessibility out there. This is something that I did a lot in the early days of freelancing because semantics and like structured data is my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. And because my head was in it, I thought everyone understood what that is. And so when I would pitch to a client or respond to an RFP, I'd say semantic markup and structured data. And that means nothing to them.
Yeah, right.
And frankly, some of these things aren't even features as much as it, you know, may break my heart. You know, a client may not value semantics or accessibility unless it's been explicitly asked of them. So right. I don't even go into those terms anymore. They're too techie, they're too nuanced, and it's really not something that comes up unless we're kind of getting into the nitty-gritty of some specific business requirements for the website.
Right. Yeah. No, totally agree.
It kind of happens behind the scenes. They don't ever know about it.
Right. Exactly. Like, it's just, I mean, even terms like standards, mm-hmm. right? The point of it is it's supposed to be default, right? Yeah. So it's kind of like, let me tell you what's default. Okay. Mm-hmm. Why? Right? Right. So it's just a matter of figuring out the context and, you know, not just defining terms for the sake of defining terms because it sounds cool or you're trying to pad some sort of RFP. If you can say something in a way that actually resonates towards the goals of the site, the goals of their business, then that makes more sense, I think.
Right. Otherwise, it's just, hey, look at my big brain.
Right. Exactly. So with all this in mind, let's talk about web development from that non-web / client perspective.
Mm-hmm. I have to tell you a little joke that I wanted to tell you offline, but I thought maybe our listeners might appreciate this. So when we recorded the last episode, our listeners, if you've heard it, you know we kind of doubled down on the home building analogies. And after the episode, you said to me, you're like, we really went ham on that analogy. And me, I don't even know what that meant, but I heard ham and we were talking. And so I was like, ham radio? Okay, maybe we were old school. Like, I didn't even know what you meant and had to go look it up after our conversation to be like, oh.
I'm surprised you didn't know considering that the acronym meaning.
Well, yeah, but like, I'm not into like the acronym speak. I'm only just now getting into emojis and stuff. I'm old. I feel old.
Not what the kids are saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so yeah. Anyways, in honor of not going all ham on the home building analogy, we are going to do a car building analogy.
But please note that everything I know about cars, I've learned from my husband and Top Gear / the Grand Tour. So all my analogies are based on that.
And so keep that in mind. And I know nothing about cars. So I'm trusting Leia.
Right. But I mean, like, just the overall concept, right? Like, with cars, we can go with a Ferrari mm-hmm. or a Ford, right? Like, you could customize each car as you want and go to a higher end model from the outset. Or, you know, you could go find a Honda or a Ford and just go the Pimp My Ride route, right?
right.
So let's talk a little bit more about web development.
Yeah, so I think web design and web development, especially for lay people, people outside of the web industry, they kind of sound like one and the same.
Right.
And while they are very tightly related and interconnected, they aren't the same. So web development is the process of building a website, translating all the work from that design phase into an actual interactive website that you can view on a browser.
Right. And I think it's pretty easy to just say that web development is the backbone or building blocks of the web.
Yeah. And often, you know, obviously we use terms like front end and back end, and those terms don't really mean much to a regular person. And even, you know, back end's got its own suggestive meaning.
Right.
So I think what's useful whenever I mention that I'm a front end developer, and I do say that, that is what I am, but I find it easier then to further explain that I write the code that brings Leia's designs to life on the web. I write the code that powers what people experience when they're actually visiting a website.
Yeah. And I think that makes a lot more sense than just saying front end developer.
Right.
And they, you know, it doesn't really make much sense to a lay person.
Right.
And we understand, again, that this is a simplified explanation, but we also want to emphasize this episode that simplified explanation is okay. Mm-hmm. I think our industry has a bad habit of trying to explain every single nuance of web development when a client just wants to know what's happening in each phase. You know, again, with that car analogy, it's like trying to explain every part of a driving car, like how pistons and the gas and the gears and engines work, when all you're trying to say is press the gas and the car goes forward, right? Mm-hmm. Don't overcomplicate things and get to the point to you're trying to make first.
Yep. So I think getting a little more specific about front end and back end development to tie them to these analogies, front end development would be like the frames and shell of a car, like a framework. So where the seats are, the wheel, the pedals, the windows, the gear shift, and all the other features that need to be in the car. They have to exist as a structure before you can do anything to them. And just to point out, that structure is defined during design. So I don't just start building a car. I have, well, what would it be? Are they blueprints for cars?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, blueprints, yeah.
So a car, you're referencing the blueprint and you're building that structure for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the back end development are like the gears that actually put that front end framework to life. So that's what actually drives the car and gives each of the pieces that the front end puts together some type of functionality, right? Mm-hmm. Like a gas pedal does nothing if it's not connected to the engine that actually powers the vehicle and moves it forward, aka like expression engine, the content management system, which is the back end that powers a particular website, for example, right? Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I do want to bring up the home building analogy again in this one, because I think it just further strengthens this idea of front and back end. And so with building a house, front end is putting up your walls, pouring the foundation, adding the roof. Whereas we're talking about back end, that's kind of the dynamic automated systems of the house, the plumbing, the electricity, the HVAC.
Right. That actually powers the house.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So front end's the structure, back end, I guess I think of it's like your automated systems.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the most common of all the acronyms that we throw at clients, which is HTML and CSS.
Yep. So HTML is my favorite part of web development. It really is. It's probably the simplest for tech people. But it's my favorite part. For me, it's the foundation of a great website. If you don't have good HTML, you're already starting off on the wrong foot. So HTML is the language that defines your web content. As I mentioned, it's the structure of the website. So if Leia gave me a design that had a heading and some body content and a hero image, I would write HTML that tells the browser, this is the headline, this is a paragraph of body content, this is an image, and so on. So essentially, the HTML, it's the shell of the car, the actual components that say, what's the hood? What's the door? This is the door. This is the hood. This is how the car is going to be put together.
Yeah, exactly. Like in the blueprints of a car too, right? Like you're actually pointing out what's what.
Yeah,
in
and
all
I don't write HTML just out of the cloud, you know, out of thin air. It's
right.
From the blueprint that is your design comp that was built through the phase of design.
Exactly.
That becomes my blueprint that I'm following.
Yeah, exactly. And very, very closely related and important to that HTML is semantics.
Yeah, so semantics, like I said earlier, it doesn't come up much with clients, but you know, I do think it's important, especially if you're maybe in a sales process where the client maybe wants to understand why your agency may be a better value than another one, or when you're trying to explain to a client that the way you build HTML is a certain way and therefore that's more valuable for them for different business reasons. So those are mostly the scenarios that this would come up. But semantics is when you're adding proper meaning to the proper content. So where I just described, I'm writing code that says, this is the headline, this is an image. I wouldn't label the headline as an image. I wouldn't label the paragraph as an image. They're labeled, they're coded to be very specific to the content that they're containing. And the benefit, and this is what I really try and focus on when I'm talking mm-hmm. about semantic HTML, is it's a foundation that gives our clients the added benefit. I mean, not only do you get HTML, that is the structure for your website, but search engines favor semantic markup. When you use the right code to say this is a headline, search engines say, that's a headline. That is more important than something else on the page that's maybe just a paragraph. Headlines tend to have keywords. So search engines can read a page and say, that's a headline. That's important information. That may be factored into your ranking.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that leads to another acronym, SEO. That's search engine optimization. And frankly, all of our clients know what this is.
Yeah, right.
They all do, because it's a bottom line kind of thing. And so by emphasizing that this semantic HTML helps with organic search engine optimization, that search engines favor it, that is a selling point for it. In addition to aiding SEO, semantic HTML is the foundation for accessibility. And accessibility, when I have to get into that with a client, it's really just about explaining to clients that not everyone experiences the web the same way. Some people are on a slow mobile network and don't have images displayed, or some people have vision issues and don't see a website, but rather hear it. Some people can't use a mouse, so they rely on their keyboard to use a website. And so semantic HTML is the foundation that all of these different types of people with different needs can still access the information on your website without anything special other than one standard code base.
Yeah, and we've dove into all of this information in our episode with Greg Tarnoff, mm-hmm. the Accessibility 101. So we'll be sure to link that into the show notes.
Mm-hmm. And accessibility, it may come up. It's probably going to come up as an issue, especially when we're dealing with a client that is in e-commerce. There are a lot of things that need to be taken into account when building and designing an e-online store. But it's also something that can be government mandated. Basically, any U.S., well, who knows what's going on now, but in the past, U.S. departments and agencies were beholden to something called the eGov initiative, which included being accessible. Mm-hmm. And so if you worked on a site or a subsite or a microsite or whatever for any of those agencies, you had to follow accessibility rules. But even if you're not a government agency or you don't have to follow these rules for some business requirement, a website that is inaccessible is a future legal issue. It is a problem waiting to arise. In the past year, there has just been more and more litigation against retailers, education, universities, entertainment, like, I'm blanking. I think it was Disney.
Right.
These major companies and industries have faced major litigation because their customers couldn't actually use their websites because they were not accessible to those customers.
Right. And when you stop and think about it, you might say, like, why is that such a big deal? But then you need to take a step back and understand that accessing the internet is now a human right.
Yes.
Right? This is what we're doing right now. What we're contributing with our skill set is a fundamental part of people's lives. And if you're not a part of the industry that's trying to make sure that everyone can have access to it, there can be consequences, not just your own personal ethical mindset, but financial and legal consequences as well. And large industries are being punished for ignoring these.
Penalized. I think punishment suggests that, like, I don't know, penalty, like they knew what the rules were and didn't follow them.
right.
This is what you get. You know, and with, you know, just I don't want to focus too much on accessibility because honestly, the episode with Greg Tarnoff is just excellent if you really want a good primer on the topic. But, you know, you may feel compelled to say things like Section 508 or WCAG, sometimes pronounced WCAG. These are essentially just specific standards within the field of front-end development that are defined by a standards body and followed by software makers like browsers and screen readers. And so if a client brings these up and wants them to be explained, you know, there's some sort of directive from either the government or a board of directors or something to be Section 508 compliant or WCAG compliant. They're really just the rules that me as the front-end developer should follow when I'm writing HTML or CSS or JavaScript, the other languages of front-end development. 508, Section 508 is very common within government. It isn't as modern, I'd say, as WCAG, but because it just hasn't evolved as rapidly as WCAG has. But I can say for a fact, it's still used by government agencies. Jason is literally working on a project right now for a government department to bring their legacy systems 508 compliant. So it's still very common. And then WCAG is a bit more contemporary because it seems to be a specification that's sort of evolving as our web is evolving to include like mobile devices and touch screens and things like that.
So you explained all the nuances and reasons for Section 508 and WCAG, but do you actually use these terms when speaking to a client?
No, really only if they specifically brought it up, you know, and if they've brought it up, then it's something that someone's told them they need it. It's probably not something that they are that aware of. And so it sometimes is necessary to break it down a little bit. But I think ultimately your best bet is just to focus on the bottom line, that there are accessibility standards and they allow you to have a site that helps people for, you know, however they experience your website, they can get to the content. They can access the content. They can purchase a product. They can buy a ticket no matter how they're experiencing your website.
Right. And if you want to use a car analogy when trying to explain this to a client, you know, it's pretty straightforward. Does this car have easy handles or open or easy closed doors or can it accommodate wheelchairs? Right.
In not even home building, but just construction in general, like public buildings, there are standards you have to follow because you have to be an accessible building. It's the same thing with a website. There are standards to follow to be accessible.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about HTML. How about CSS, the next really common term?
Yeah, so CSS, this is basically the code for the site look and feel. It's taking the underlying HTML, and I guess to clarify, I write HTML before I write CSS, so the HTML is the first step. And then I go in and I make that HTML look good. I make it look like Leia's designs. And I use CSS to do that. So I can make a headline purple and I can add a bunch of space on the left and the right of a paragraph. And I can move an image to the left or the right. So, you know, if we just take the car analogy, that's you have leather on the seats versus cloth or the color of the car, or maybe even, what's that called? The lines, like the fine line drawing they do on cars.
Oh, I don't know.
Like, you know, fast cars. What's pinstriping?
Right. Like, or any other custom kind of paint job or some other type of thing, right? In order to make it look exactly the way you want it, right?
Yeah. And, you know, another thing, you know, we're going to talk a little bit later about responsive web design, mobile web design, but CSS, it's not just colors and spacing, but it also controls how a website looks when you view it on your phone and what it might look like if you looked at it on your iPad and what it might look like if you are on your desktop. So it's still the look and feel, but it also is much, much more robust than colors.
Yes, absolutely. And then after that, there's another level, another acronym that is involved, and that's JS or JavaScript.
Yeah, so JavaScript is kind of the last thing I add when I'm building a website. It's essentially what adds behavior or interaction to the site. And you know, I feel like that's how a lot of us explain it, but I feel like that is even a little technical sounding.
Right. Like, this is the behavior of the site. Like, what does that sounds a little bit weird.
Right.
So I feel like sometimes the easiest way, whether it's accurate or not, you know, because again, like at the beginning of the episode, I'm saying, okay, we might be using terms that might not be 100% exactly right, but saying like it makes this thing move. Or it adds animation, you know, with JavaScript. That could be an easy way to just simply explain whatever something is happening with JavaScript. Another simple one, too, is that, okay, and I'll, again, not 100% accurate because there could be server-side checks, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, JavaScript can be used in a front-end version to check if someone filled a form correctly, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and honestly, kind of like CSS, JavaScript is so much more robust than that.
Yeah.
I am not the strongest JavaScript developer, so I'm not the one to go deep into all the other things it can do. But frankly, I don't do that with clients. You know,
exactly.
Even if we need robust JavaScript and have to contract it out, the client just needs to know that we're going to make sure when someone fills out a form, when they submit, if they haven't put in a valid email address or phone number, they'll get a little error. And so that's something that they can completely understand. And that's something that JavaScript supports.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're thinking about a car, you know, some cars are outfitted with those backing cameras to check the curb. Mm-hmm. And it gives you like a beeping sound if you're getting too close and then it turns red and all that kind of stuff. So that's the same thing like when, you know, you're trying to fill out a form, is something wrong? Is something missing? And the JavaScript is the code that helps check that, to mm-hmm. check mistakes.
And I think that analogy is sort of a nice way of also adding the note. And I'm not sure I would always bring this up with clients, but it is worth saying JavaScript should not be required on a site, in my opinion. This is something that, as you just described, on a car, if it has that backup camera. Well, if you don't have that backup camera, can you still back up?
Yes.
Do you know
exactly.
what I mean? So if
totally.
If someone, if for some reason JavaScript isn't working, can someone still fill out a form and submit it?
Exactly.
So that's the point, is I believe my fundamental philosophy is that JavaScript is that extra layer that kind of, it's like the delicious frosting on the cake.
I like that. I like that. Yeah. And I actually love that you pointed out that can you still back up without staring at that camera?
Right.
Absolutely
exactly.
true. Absolutely true. So I feel like those were the fundamental things that the acronyms that we usually talk mm-hmm. when developing a website. But all of that leads us to another very popular acronym and phrase that involves all the things that we just said, which is RWD. And mobile.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's so often RWD stands for responsive web design. And sometimes it's treated interchangeably with the term mobile, but they're not the same thing. So mobile essentially refers to the concept of being on a mobile device, looking at a site, viewing a site being viewed from a mobile device. So that could be a phone, a tablet, you know.
Anything you can carry, really.
Yeah, anything that you're not tethered, almost anything that like you're on Wi-Fi or data or something like that.
Right.
So that's mobile. And responsive web design is the concept of making sure the site looks and works great, maybe not exactly the same, but looks and works great, whether you're on a phone or a desktop. So it's less about whether you're connected to something and mobile and more about the device you're using.
Right. And it gets more complicated because something can be responsive, but still not mobile friendly,
mm-hmm.
right? Because some people try to interpret responsive as let's just shrink something so it fits in phones. Okay, so now we can load on a site. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you can use that site as well as it can be on that phone. It just simply means it loads on the site, right? So that means it's not mobile friendly.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this topic is one that lends itself well to analogies of itself, because
right.
I don't even think you need to get into cars or houses, because right. a lot of people today understand being mobile.
Right.
Because they have like a mobile data plan or something like that,
right.
and they understand using a different device.
Right.
And so we would try and put it in the context of that sort of kind of almost human today experience.
Right.
So, for example, you're saying something can be responsive and not mobile friendly. Well, mobile friendly, one of the things to be mobile friendly is to be fast.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, if you're not connected to a network through a cable, that you can still view that site really quickly. That has nothing to do with whether you're on a phone or a tablet or a desktop. It's just not the same. So it can look great on your phone, but it can be really, really slow to load. So it's
right.
responsive, but not mobile friendly.
Yeah. So that's really important to note. So I think it's important to define some of these things, especially when you're trying to sell some sort of responsive web design or mobile solution for your client. Because mm-hmm. some clients these days, they might come to us saying like, okay, my site loads on a phone, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's actually being optimized and maximized for its potential to actually help their business on mobile devices, right? And we do have a few resources that we'll add to our show notes about responsive web design. And specifically, we do have a responsive retrofit episode mm-hmm. with real world client examples, you know, breaking all the nuances down.
Mm-hmm. All right. So moving on, I think it's worth bringing up a topic that we actually don't bring up too often in the beginning of a project, but it does come up, especially when we are handing over the site for the client to see for the first time in the browser, and they're going to test it and click around and things right. like that. So this browsers and compatibility.
Right. And that is a front end subject. Totally. Right. Totally. And I feel like sometimes people gloss over that because they are too focused on HTML and CSS. Let's think about where that's actually being rendered, which is our browsers. The important thing to impress upon.
Well, actually, I just want to interrupt you.
Sure.
What you just said was super techie. So oh. where it's actually rendered. Like
oh,
what,
right.
what client's going to ever yeah. understand that? And so like when we were talking with a client you referenced early where we had to explain some of the acronyms,
right.
one of the things I asked her when I got to explaining, you know, what a browser or got to saying the word browser, I said, do you know what a browser is? Just to ask, because that term people may not know. They may understand Internet Explorer or they might right. understand Chrome. I mean, gosh, I know more clients that understand Internet Explorer than any other brand name.
Right, of course.
But anyway, so it's important to not just say where it's rendered, but explain that, you know, the browser is the software on your phone or on your computer that you open up and type in an address to go see a website. So it's what shows you the website.
Yeah. And I think the next step once they understand that is that everything that we're coding for them is actually understood differently depending on whether you're looking at this on a Mac or a PC or on your phone. Right.
Yeah.
So that's really important to set the tone for your client that not everything will look exactly the same or behave exactly the same simply because all those different devices will treat the code that we create differently.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that I bring up when I hand something over and I'm giving them instructions on how to test.
Right.
So I explain that I need to know if they're on a PC, and if they're on a PC, what operating system and version they're on, and then what browser they're on. And so that's the context of why they need to understand what each of those things are. Because when they're testing, if they find something, any front-end developer knows we need to know those details in order to begin troubleshooting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can get so nuanced because there's so many different ages of computer. So mm-hmm. it's not even just between Mac, PC, or iPhone, or Android. What version are they using and how are they somebody who updates their system very often or not, right?
Yeah, or if they've installed some sort of, you know, browser add-on.
Oh,
so
totally.
Many things are, you know, and that's why it's important to educate your clients about this because you will sometimes go down this rabbit hole. You know, yeah. when they're reporting a problem and you're trying to figure out what on earth is happening on their end, and it ends up being isolated to their computer or their device.
Yeah, absolutely. And at that point, sometimes it's actually more cost effective and time effective by just picking up the phone and walking mm-hmm. through that problem. And that mm-hmm. helps you understand whether it is an isolated incident to their computer. Because when you were just talking and explaining over like, maybe it's just them, mm-hmm. maybe it's just their own very, very specific install, it reminded me that we got a troubleshooting message about a content management system login situation where she kept mentioning it doesn't log me out. Every time I log out, it logs me back in. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a crazy bug. I wonder what's going on. I wonder if it's a Internet Explorer issue or whatever, or a version issue. And we just need to update. On and on and on and on it went. And then so I picked up the phone and went through the process with her on her site using her login at the same time. And I didn't have the same issue as her when I went through all of it. And then fast forward, it's because she had this LastPass browser add-on that had auto-complete, auto-login hooked up, mm-hmm. right? So it's funny how, you know, us as web designers and web developers, we can get calls that are completely unrelated to web design and development, but might seem like it actually is related to you and it is just the browser mm-hmm. or something very, very specific. Mm-hmm. So usually when we're talking about browsers and compatibility with clients, you know, we try to tell stories a lot more than analogies, because I feel like it's hard to explain an analogy with this won't work over here or there. Mm-hmm. So like another example is like, you know, one of our past clients was talking about how they couldn't see the site properly on their computer. And then when I found out that they were looking at the site at a hospital where they worked, and considering the context of the medical industry and hospitals and how slow they are to update their systems, we found out it was just like literally an isolated incident that no one else will ever see mm-hmm. this site on that very specific situation ever. So they didn't need to pay us costly amount of time and money to fix an issue that didn't need to be fixed.
Yep. You know, you mentioned it's always a good idea to jump on the phone, but also jump on the phone and be ready for some screen sharing. You know, have something set up where you can see their system.
Yeah, absolutely. So now that we've set all the definitions for this episode, let's talk about the process that we mm-hmm. actually follow for all these moving parts. So how can we describe that, especially in relation to each other?
Well, I do think it's important to emphasize, not in too much detail, but when you're explaining to a client, especially in the sales process, that there are standards, best practices when it comes to web development. And, you know, not everyone follows them. And it's mm-hmm. frankly to the detriment of that client. It's not a detriment to the web developer. You know, it's the client who's going to suffer if standards aren't followed. And so me as a web developer, I need to stay informed and follow web standards, just like a building contractor has to be licensed and needs to know what the new codes are for his city, or a mechanic. I don't know, do they get licensed or... They have to have training.
Well, someone who actually builds the car will need mm-hmm. to be an engineer.
Right.
So they would have to follow specific codes. And even diving deep into that, there's like fuel efficiency rules mm-hmm. and things like that that people have to follow. So that, I guess it varies state by state, but regardless, the point is there's rules that everyone has to follow to fit a specific standard so that mm-hmm. the product that you get is superior.
Exactly. And not only is the product superior, but it's more cost effective because, right. frankly, it costs more to fix a poorly coded site than it costs to build it right the first time. So right. if your site isn't semantic or it isn't accessible or your CSS isn't mobile friendly, it's going to cost you more in the long run. And that's why standards are important.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the actual process of building a site. So at the beginning, I mentioned, you know, the Ferrari or Ford analogy. We can go all out, bling it out, have the highest end model, or we could start off small and add to the car. We could also customize the car. And that's the same with the web. You can mm-hmm. have a budget for a highly custom site, and we could add more bells and whistles and testing and way more solid code to make the foundation of your site rock solid. So I think the analogy for me, like if we're using cars again, it's like choosing carbon fiber versus like sheet metal, right? So carbon fiber is the higher end material. Mm-hmm. And that's like the lightweight and optimized code because it helps make a site fast because there's less weight on the site, right? And the reason why it's important to point something like that out, because there's more than one way to code a site. and it can still work, right? Both ways you can code a site can still have a page show up on the browser without any issues, but it takes more time and effort to make that process actually efficient and trouble-free in the future. The other thing too is if you have less of a budget, it might mean we'll need to test on less devices and browsers, right? You know, for example, that hospital situation that I mentioned, well, if that's just the one isolated incident where this person was viewing it, well, does it make sense for us to spend the extra time and money to make the site look good on those computers when that person's the only one looking at it there, right? So there's really kind of like a rabbit hole that you could go into when trying to explain, you know, how far a site needs to be customized in the front end.
Yeah, but still making sure that a client understands that that foundation, regardless of their budget, is still going to be supported.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that it's part of also the process of helping the client prioritize.
Yes.
Because no client has an open-ended budget. I mean, I've certainly never found one. And so everyone's got some budget and you have to fit in with that. And so it's, whether it's during the sales process or during the early part of the project planning process, explaining to them where they can save money now or where we could shift something to later, where it is smart to invest, like I was explaining, good semantic markup following standards. That's always a good investment. But do you need the JavaScript frosting for phase one or can that wait till later? So it's a matter of helping them prioritize and doing it in a way that doesn't get too technical about, oh, well, we can skip the JavaScript. Instead, say, well, can we skip that form giving an error if someone gives the wrong phone number or the wrong phone number format? Can we skip that for later? You know, that kind of questioning.
Or even like when we're dealing with responsive web design or mobile development, we could have super rock solid HTML, but we won't have all the CSS for every single device known to man. But we could launch with a few devices that we'll test with that will accommodate a majority of mobile devices, right? So we've just spoken and defined everything we could about front-end development, and there's still more to say, but we're going to end it right here with the note that all front-end is influenced by web design. Like, this entire series is building upon each other, and eventually
just the way they build on each other in a project.
Yes. And eventually that episode before this one, the web design one, and this episode on web development will influence our next episodes, which will dive into the functionality that we kind of hinted about when we were trying to say there's a difference between front end and back end development, like how to update the content of the site. Or like in a car, how can we customize this car to do things that other cars don't do? Right?
Yep. So that brings us to the end of today's episode. And normally we would be doing our rapid fire 10 questions, but Leigh and I have both already answered them this year in previous episodes. So I'm actually going to put Leigh on the spot and just ask her one question.
Okay.
She's not ready for this one. So Leigh, what's your go-to karaoke song?
Oh my gosh. Don't Speak by No Doubt. That is definitely my number one. I've got a list. I've got a repertoire, but it's Don't Speak, No Doubt. Yeah. Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Backup Pro.
We'd also like to thank our hosting partner, Arcus Tech.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. And if you really like this episode, consider donating to the show. Our links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when Andy McCormick joins the show to chat about disaster planning using the cloud. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leigh Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.